I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. As events unfold in Boston, we are exploring Monday's bombing investigation from three different perspectives. We're going to start things off with Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen, who's been writing about the bombings for the Boston Globe. He's on his cell phone in the area that is the focus of the manhunt for the remaining suspect. And Kevin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty.
Tell us where you are, Kevin.
Well, I'm leaving Cambridge. I actually have to get back to the Globe to file something. I'm going to try to file a column online because what I found in Cambridge, I spent most of my time in Cambridge. They believe Jahar Zadniev is holed up somewhere in Watertown where there was a gunfight last night where his older brother, Tamerlan, was shot and killed. They are believed to be the two men pictured in those images that were released last night by the FBI. Now, there's a very conflicting image being drawn of the two brothers. Tamerlan, I was told, was apparently only recently, in recent years, was devoutly Muslim and adhered to a very strict and sort of extremist version of Islam that was rejected by the vast majority of Muslims in Cambridge, and that his brother, Jahar, was seemingly completely Americanized. He came here as a boy. Now, there's conflicting reports about whether they were from near Chechnya. I was told by friends of Jahar who went to high school with them that they were from Kyrgyzstan, and that that is a part of one of the former Soviet republics that's sort of in the middle of Asia, Central Asia. And so it's unclear, but it is clear that the older brother, Tamerlan, had extremist views. Apparently, one of my colleagues at Boston Globe has found writings of his in which he bemoaned the Harry Potter series of books as being paganistic. And that children should not be allowed to read Harry Potter. So I think that gives you an indication, if in fact that's true, of where he was coming from. But the image that I'm getting from people who knew Jahar, the kid who's holed up, the 19-year-old, one girl described him as a class clown, and that he was on the wrestling team. Now, I know that, and I have a friend who's from Kyrgyzstan, and he said that wrestling is their favorite sport. It's a very small country. I think it's maybe 5 million people. It's one of the poorest countries, if not the poorest former Soviet republic, but they are terrific at wrestling. They medal in Greco-Roman wrestling almost every Olympics. That's how good they are in that sport. And that's apparently Jahar was good enough. This kid who went to school and told me that he went to the state sectionals. So he must have been a terrific wrestler. I was also told that he had at least attended sometime the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth, which is in the southeast of the state here in Massachusetts, and that the kid that I talked to said that Jahar was one of a number of students at Ringe in Latin School in Cambridge that received a scholarship. He remembers it distinctly on the senior night that Jahar and everybody cheered for him, that he got like a $2,500 scholarship to use for college. So we're getting this really bizarre sort of, you know, it's like everything. Whenever we find something like this, we'll say, what did they do to, why do they hate us? And the us is us. These kids lived here for most of their lives. And by all accounts, Jahar particularly was sort of completely Americanized, completely Westernized. And by these same accounts, Tamerlan changed as he grew here. He was much older. He's 26 years old, apparently, according to the people who know him. And that Tamerlan became increasingly strident. He complained that he didn't have any friends in America. He apparently held very anti-American views. And yet, this is what's so bizarre, Marty. I don't know if you know anything about Cambridge.
A little bit.
Cambridge is probably the most tolerant swath of the United States, along with maybe Berkeley in California. It is a sanctuary city for immigrants. It is, I mean, we jokingly call it the People's Republic of Cambridge because it is so, the only word to describe it is progressive. And then I guess other critics would describe it as being lefty and pinko and all that stuff. But I'm telling you, Cambridge is the most welcoming community to people from other countries and other cultures. It's the most multicultural city in Massachusetts and in New England. And if the idea that kids could grow up there and harbor views that might lead them to do what the authorities allege they did on Patriots Day, it just blows my mind. It is not, it doesn't fit any picture other than a morose, disaffected, disenfranchised older brother leading a sort of guileless or clueless little brother into a horrific, horrific set of events.
Kevin, apparently the Associated Press talked with these young men's father in Russia. So do from what you know, do they have family in the United States?
Yes, they have uncles in Maryland. I don't know if they have family here. I haven't found them. But I know that a friend of mine at WBZ-TV here in Boston, the CBS affiliate, Peter Wilson, he's a terrific journalist, he got a hold of an uncle down in Maryland, and that uncle did also, this has just been, I think it's been posted, I know that Peter put it on air, and in which the uncle said that he had not had much contact, and that Tamerlan, a couple of years ago, reached out to him after many years of estrangement and suggested that, you know, they needed to get together more as a family. And the uncle said that when he asked Tamerlan what he was doing, Tamerlan explained that he was going deeper into Islam. And the uncle's response was, "We've always been with Islam." But what it seems like is that he started embracing a radical form of Islam, not the inclusive religion of Islam that is followed by the vast majority of Muslims here in Massachusetts and the rest of the United States. So this is what is being developed right now. And I got to stress, Marty, that none of this is confirmed. I mean, I know the kid I talked to knew Jaha. He approached me and said, "Are you here for Jaha?"
Hmm.
And I didn't even know how to pronounce the kid's name at that point. And he also, you know, he described him as doing things that I have since called back to the Globe News Group, and those have been confirmed. We know this kid graduated from Cambridge Ridge and Latin High School. We know that he got a scholarship. We know that he went to UMass Dartmouth at some point. I don't know if he was still enrolled as a student. But the image that we're getting is, again, the disaffected, angry big brother leading the little brother down a road which the authorities say, you know, is what we've seen. And I got to tell you, I just found out an hour ago that the police officer at MIT, at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is someone I know. His name is Sean Collier. And the last time I saw Sean in person was probably a year and a half ago, and he was all excited because he worked as a civilian in the Somerville. He's a Somerville kid. He worked as a civilian in the Somerville Police Department. He desperately wanted to become a police officer. And he told me, I just walked through, I was going to see the deputy chief in Somerville, and he said, "Hey, I got on MIT. And I go, "That's awesome, Sean." And my heart broke when I got an email from another police officer I know in Somerville. He said, "Sean was killed."
Yeah, and I know that you know firefighters who've been affected by this as well, Kevin, because I've heard you talking about it, and from what I have been reading and hearing and listening to, it sounds like this police officer, this MIT officer, shot in his car before these two brothers took off on a chase. Do the authorities, do you know where they think Jahar is, or is there a part of Boston that investigators are looking at?
They're looking at Watertown. I mean, the short answer is they're not exactly sure where he is, or if they are, they're not sharing that with us. I talked to a state police officer I know very well early this morning at about 5 o'clock this morning, and he told me their nightmare scenario is that Jahar has gone into a house and is, for lack of a better word, has hostages. When they brought, this police officer also told me that when they brought, I'm trouble keeping this straight. Tamerlan to the Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital. That's where he was brought with obviously life-threatening wounds. He not only had bullet wounds from police officers who engaged him in a firefight, he had blast burns, and they think he may have had an explosive device on him.
Attached to his body,
Yeah, and they did find a trigger. When the surgeons or the emergency people were working on him, trying to save his life, I mean, how ironic is this? Yeah. He's actually in a hospital with 12 people who were gravely injured by what police say was his bomb. And they were fighting to save his life, and they found a triggering device on him. So that is the presumption is that they have to work under this presumption that Chahar also has explosives. Now, the other thing the state cop told me, he was behind some of the lead vehicles, but he saw explosions. He described them as sort of things hitting off the street as they were chasing these kids in a... They apparently stole somebody's Mercedes SUV. And then bizarrely released the guy, didn't even hurt him, after driving around for quite some time. And then when the police got on them, it sounds like it from what the police... He couldn't confirm it, but the police officer told me, he says, we think it's grenades. They won't know. It could have been an improvised explosive device, too. But he said they were bouncing off the street. It's like a very bad James Bond movie when I'm describing this.
Well, Kevin, we have to say goodbye to you in about a minute or so, but I'm just if you could describe for us what it is like to be in this part of Massachusetts around Boston where people are told to stay indoors, where the subway traffic has stopped, the mass transit has stopped, people are not on the streets, told right. to shelter in place. Just how bizarre does that look?
I guess the word surreal, I don't like using the word surreal because I always think it's overused and overused, but I think surreal fits it today because I added up quickly in my head, if you add the cities and towns that are effectively under lockdown, there are 1 million people who are confined to their homes.
Wow.
And believe me, there weren't many people out in Cambridge. I was surprised that I found this kid, but I just went down to the high school and he was walking by it. And but there aren't, people are obeying this. There's obviously a lot of fear. There's a belief that this kid is so desperate that he's quite prepared to die. And he's quite prepared to take other people with him. But it's just, I can't tell you how, I always say that Boston's the biggest, the smallest big city in America. And every day I find that I know more people that were affected by this. I mean, I could barely keep it together when I found out a firefighter, a friend of mine, had to carry poor Janie Richards into an ambulance.
Yeah.
And he knew her. And every day it seems like this, it just won't end. But I think we are at the denouement. Well, my French is pretty lousy. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And Kevin, we have to say goodbye. And I thank you once again so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
And we've heard from a lot of people in Philly. I've gotten tons of emails from people.
Believe me,
that matters.
Indeed. When that's Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Sony Classics, The Company You Keep, a new thriller directed by and starring Robert Redford, with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon about one man's journey to outrun the FBI and his radical past. Now playing.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at IamConcerned.org.
PIFA, a Kimmel Center production, supports WHYY and presents Rufus Wainwright and Prima, Rufus, Judy on Sunday, April 21st in Verizon Hall. This two-part evening opens with excerpts from Wainwright's opera Prima Donna, featuring the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia and vocal soloists Melody Moore and Catherine Guthrie. After intermission, Wainwright himself recreates Judy Garland's fabled 1961 Carnegie Hall debut. Lead sponsor, TD Bank. Tickets for Rufus Wainwright are available at PIFA.org.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are doing what you are doing, which is to try to keep up with the unfolding events in Boston, exploring the aftermath of Monday's bombings at the Boston Marathon. We just said goodbye to Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen, who joined us a couple of days ago, just to help us understand what is happening in Cambridge and in parts of Boston that are in essential lockdown. We want to get a better understanding of the history of the Chechen rebellion against Russia and how Chechen nationals fighting for independence have become radicalized in recent years. And joining us now is Emma Gilligan of the University of Connecticut. And Emma, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
You're welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, any questions you might have, and we're talking specifically, and there's much we don't know. We don't know all the connections between these brothers, but it looks like there is some, at least some loose connection to Chechnya. Any questions related to that, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Emma, let me just get some really basic information on the table before we talk about what has been happening in Chechnya and its relationship to Russia. But first of all, tell us where Chechnya is, and I guess its role in this Caucasus region of Russia.
Sure. The Chechen region is in the northern Caucasus, and that is essentially north of Georgia and south of the Stavropol region in southern Russia. The two most important republics that buffer Chechnya are Ingushetia and Dagestan.
And Chechen rebels have, I mean, for years now, really. In fact, back in 1991, they tried to break away from, I guess, then the Soviet Union. Boris Yeltsin sent in troops in 1994. There is a rebellious group inside of Chechnya. Help us understand who these people are.
Yeah, it's a very complex history, obviously, Marty, and it does begin with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the call for independence by the Chechen people, which was not dissimilar to other republics who also wanted independence. Unfortunately, the ways in which the Chechens fought for independence were not liked by Boris Yeltsin, essentially, and he sent forces in 1994 try and quell the independence movement. Now, as you said earlier, this did begin in the First Chechen War as very much a nationalist war. Mm-hmm. And some of the defining characteristics of that war did then shape what happened later in the Second Chechen War. So, for example, we know that a huge amount of disproportionate violence was used against Chechen civilians and Chechen fighters during the First War. And we see the setting up in that region of patterns of filtration points and disappearances and torture. And then we see a small segment in the Chechen separatist movement that become extremely radicalized. And it is then what plays out after the First Chechen War is this tension between the moderates and the radicals. And unfortunately, the radicals that we have today are really the result of the radical movement that grew out of the interim period between the First and the Second War.
I don't want to go too far out on a limb here, but the brother who was killed earlier this morning, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, is 26 years old. Frankly, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know how long he has been living in the United States, but it seems he would have been a teenager when much of this unrest was in Chechnya.
Yeah, and that's a very good point, Marty. With the information that I've been able to capture this morning, it looked as though both of the brothers came here in 2000, which was just after the beginning of the Second Chechen War. So both of them would have been, the older brother would have been 14 and the younger brother would have been 6 or 7. And so therefore, in particular, the older brother would have experienced the most horrendous decade of conflict and violence from 1994 all the way through to 2000 at a very vulnerable time as a young man for both of them, essentially, yes.
And we have also heard a conversation with the boy's father from the Associated Press saying that his son's my son is a true angel. He said, talking certainly about his second, both of his children, and obviously the difficulty of figuring out what the story is here and all the interconnections. But and it wasn't until a couple of days ago that the president, President Obama, used the word terrorists, and that's a very loaded word for us to have.
Yeah.
But from your perspective, do you think that's what we're talking about here?
I'm not sure, and I think that we're going to determine more as the situation unfolds and we find out more. Any which way that you, whether they have a political, ideological affiliation, whether the two young men have been used by another organization within the region, but we're unsure about that. Or is this two young men who have suffered post-traumatic stress disorder and their experiences of the conflict and haven't been treated properly, and that this is an indication of not giving appropriate psychological treatment to people who seek refuge in other countries. We're not exactly sure of what those links could be, but I have to say that essentially it doesn't make sense. Because if you think about the history of the radical wing of the Chechen separatist movement, is that they have not taken it largely outside the Russian Federation. So for them to take a strategic step to conduct a terrorist operation in Boston seems completely out of context with the history of what they've done so far. I'm not saying that that's not possible. It just doesn't fit so far with the history of this movement as we know it.
And the history of this movement is that they see, what, Russia as their enemy?
They see Russia, but essentially the radicals can also see the United States as their enemy as well, both for perhaps feeling as though the massive human rights violations that were inflicted upon them weren't dealt with sufficiently by the international community. But, you know, they may also see a United States as an enemy because they're fighting against, conceivably, from their point of view, fighting against Muslims in other parts of the world.
Talking with Emma Gilligan in this portion of Radio Times today, providing some context, some background to what we believe to be true, which is that the two young men, one of whom was killed earlier this morning and the other basically on the loose, what possible ties they might have to Chechnya. It appears that they do have some familial ties to Chechnya. And our guest, Emma Gilligan, is a professor at the University of Connecticut. Any questions or comments that you might have, again, talking very specifically about this piece of the story, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. And in a couple of minutes, we'll be talking about the role that surveillance cameras have played in this ongoing investigation. Emma, going back to Chechnya, I mean, would it be fair to say that this movement that wanted to break away from Russia, that many members of this movement have been radicalized by perhaps Islamists?
Yes, I think we can see that, Marty, and there's you know a couple of events that are really testimony to that. So we know that. You may recall yourself that when radical Chechens took the theater, the theater, the Dubrovka theater in Moscow, when they took the hostages, about 500 hostages, during a performance there in 2002. Now, what we saw at that event was something that we had never seen before, and that was the influence of foreign fighters and particularly Saudi Arabians. So, for example, actually in the theater, what we had was signs in Arabic, not in Chechen, not in Russian, but in Arabic, for example. We also had Chechen women who had self-detonating bombs. They're called Black Widows, and they were prepared to blow themselves up. But also, they were also dressed in Saudi-style dress. So for the first time, we have them in black veils and jilbabs, for example. We had these black banners with white inscriptions on them saying there is no God on earth other than Allah, right? So this was a far more sophisticated enterprise. They weren't hiding the fact that there was foreign influence, and that perhaps that indeed was a tactic being used by them to show the world that they had support outside of Chechnya. So Dubrovka, the events there were really instrumental in our understanding of how this had become a broader international campaign. Now, connections with Al-Qaeda, connections with Osama bin Laden, really difficult for us to comment on that. We know that Osama bin Laden did begin to make speeches that included Chechnya. So, you know, when he was talking about Al-Qaeda's international jihad and all the nationalist battlefronts across the world, you know, in Palestine, in Iraq, in Somalia, in Kashmir, then Chechnya was part of that litany that he began to include. We also know that there was a Jordanian Chechen and a Saudi Arabian who were part of the political structure, part of the leadership structure of the radical wing of the Chechen movement. So clearly there are links. We know that there were Azeri fighters, Arab fighters, Turk fighters, Kurds, but it is still a very small component of what is, and I think largely remains, a nationalist issue. But where it's also changed is that they've also extended their own network in the region. So they have jamaats in Ingushetia or in Dagestan. And these jamaats sometimes work as a part of the network and sometimes work individually on their own. So there is support for an Islamist state indeed in the region, but there are schisms now as to whether that is the strategy that Chechnya should take.
And final question to you, Emma Gilligan. I mean, as this story unfolds, is there something that you will be looking for with the kind of expertise that you have in this region of the world?
Well, I'll be looking to know more about the background of the young men involved and their family. The background of their family, what the boys actually experienced, did they experience war firsthand? And essentially, you know, one would like to know more about the kind of life that they lived in the United States and the connections perhaps that they maintained in the region.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. And that's Emma Gilligan of the University of Connecticut. Well, as we know, video surveillance cameras were crucial in the identification of these bombing suspects. And we want to talk now to security expert Terry Bolt at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs about the technology and its use and limitations for law enforcement. And Terry Bolt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, it was less than 24 hours ago that the FBI posted these videos of these two men walking through the streets of Boston with these backpacks on. And I have to say, it's pretty breathtaking that here we are today, you know, the next day, one of these young men has been killed. The other is somewhere in Boston and being looked for. It seems like it happened so quickly.
Well, that's a testament to the quality of the FBI investigators using this information and other information to track down the suspects.
Looking at that video that was first posted, and it looks like it came from some of the businesses on this particular street. Help us understand, I guess, how these surveillance cameras work.
Well, surveillance cameras have both public uses, so there's some there for street corners and looking at traffic and whatever. Others, like one of the cameras used in this incident, were protecting establishments that use video surveillance to deter people from trying to break into their facilities and then provide video that can be used if there was an incident for prosecution. So cameras record, generally in this case, the cameras are recording inside the establishment. They're not public, But then when an incident happens like this, the FBI and the police have access to go in and ask for all these videos and try and collect information they can use to track down the suspect.
And I have to say that when I first saw those images, I was surprised at how clear they were. Were you?
Actually, for some of them, they are quite good. Cameras continue to improve in quality. We've come a long way from the video surveillance cameras that were using VHS tapes over and over again. They were so grainy you could hardly use them. The quality still, you know, it's good at one level. They've been enhanced. You can tell from some of them they've been blown up and enhanced. But the quality is good enough that if you really know the suspect, you can probably identify them. Still not as good as some of the other photos posted mm-hmm. on the web now. Are clearly they've identified the suspect and they found other photos of them, you know, nice passport or driver's license photos. The video quality, though, is continues to improve, and that will only improve our ability to do this. It did help that it was at daytime with good lighting and the suspects were close enough to these cameras. We didn't see the photos from cameras that were so far away they weren't that useful.
Well, and I, you know, we're trying to get into the heads of the investigators. I would assume under a circumstance such as this is that they also looked at perhaps people's cell phone videos or images as well, just to try to, I guess, reconstruct what was happening on that street on Monday.
My guess is they did. They haven't actually released any of those photos, so it's hard to know what was collected. But collecting videos or images from anyone who's, you know, has them in the area. It used to be they collected and still do collect a lot of eyewitness testimony, but rather than saying, mm-hmm. well, I saw a guy with a backpack, to have a photo of the guy with a backpack, which can then make sure it's the same guy from some other view, tracking them through the crowd. In fact, some of the videos that have been posted show not that you can really identify the person, but you can sort of see it's the same person you saw someplace else, and then you find the one camera that had a really good shot of their face, and that can help you identify both what they did, track them through the crowd and understand they're in a relationship with each other, understand that they were on the phone here, their backpack was there, it's not here, all that kind of information pieces together to give investigators insights into what is likely to have happened.
About a minute before our break here, but as you looked at that surveillance video, was there anything that struck you?
Well, it's the other thing that strikes me is, well, it's a guy wearing a baseball cap, a black jacket, and a backpack, and I wondered how many other people in Boston were doing that. So this is where the photos become much more useful, because it's not just any backpack, it's not just any hat. They can re-identify the same subject much, much better. The quality of them was pretty good, although from a facial recognition point of view, I would still worry if you tried to search through a national database to find someone. Those photos are not good enough to get great IDs from that, but they're good enough to give them possible suspects, and more importantly, allow them to link information over time and to other credible sources of information they may get.
Well, let's take that short break and get back, and then we will get back to our conversation, also opening up the phone calls, or the phone lines, I should say, at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're talking about the use of video surveillance cameras in this particular case, talking with security expert Terry Bolt, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers minimally invasive procedures designed to help people overcome strokes and brain aneurysms. Physicians use interventional techniques through small incisions to help speed recovery. Patient stories at abingtonpowertoheal.org.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing Education at PAFA offers art classes for all ages and levels of experience this summer, including landscape, watercolor, portrait painting, and more. PAFA Continuing Education is hosting an open house on Saturday, April 20th, where prospective students can meet the faculty and staff, tour the historic cast hall, drawing and painting studios, printmaking and sculpture shops, and view demonstrations. Details on the April 20th open house online at pafa.edu/ce.
Choose PA Wind supports WHYY and encourages energy consumers in Pennsylvania to power their businesses and homes with energy from in-state wind farms. More on clean, local wind power online at choosepawind.com/Philly.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As you probably know by now, one of the two men identified in surveillance video and described as suspects in the bombing attacks at Monday's Boston Marathon by the FBI is dead after a shootout with the police that was earlier this morning. An MIT police officer was also killed earlier this morning. The other suspect is still at large, considered dangerous. Law enforcement conducting door-to-door searches in Boston in the Boston area. Residents in the area have been told to stay indoors to shelter in place. Two of the suspects have been identified as brothers. And we're talking with Terry Bolt. He's the L. Pomar Endowed Chair of Communication and Computation and Professor of Computer Science at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. He directs the Vision and Security Technology Lab, focusing on security, including surveillance and biometrics and sensor networks. And any questions you might have about how this surveillance works and how it might be working in this investigation, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Terry Bolt, going back to you, I want to understand, I guess, what computers can do when it comes to things like facial recognition.
So the state-of-the-art in facial recognition is very good. If you have a passport-like photo or a driver's license, straight ahead, good quality, they can get pretty good identification rates out of that. As the quality of the images degrade, it becomes more and more difficult to separate out exactly who is the person. Anyone looking at these photos can tell, for example, something about their apparent hair color, whether it's dyed or not, you don't know. You can tell something about their apparent skin color, some general characteristics about their face, but there's probably one out of 1,000 people might actually match a number of their characteristics. If you tried to actually search a national database and say, it is this person. The value of the information, though, is it gives the investigators an opportunity to whittle down the pool of millions of suspects down to thousands and then use other information to try and connect the dots between them. So it's not going to say it is exactly this person, but it'll give you a pretty good indication of it's not these people and it might be this group, and keep looking for more information.
And are the computers then looking for the sort of configuration between the nose, the eyes, the mouth, the chin, sort of the architecture of the face?
So there are different face recognition algorithms. Some of them use more geometric characteristics. Some of them use almost 3D models internally where they're looking at some of those geometric relationships. The distance between the eyes and the nose apparently changes as you change you tilt your head up and down, left and right. But in 3D, of course, they're rigid. But from a 2D image, you have to do a lot of work to try and estimate what would be the consistency. A number of the algorithms are actually using more textures where they're looking at the fine information on the face, which is why they do well with a passport photo, because you can see the mole that's on my chin, and not very many other people have a mole. That helps differentiate me. Just using the spatial geometry is not it. As accurate, but that's all you can get from very blurry photos.
And you talk about the national database, so I'm assuming people's passport pictures are in there, driver's license. What else might be in there?
Well, so there actually is not a single national database. If you have a passport, then there is a database of passports. The border crossings, INS maintains visa photos of people who are coming into the United States, where they also collect fingerprints and other information. Driver's license are independent by state. They're not in a nationalized database, although under recent changes in the law that the states share all of that, we'll be sharing that information with the feds as necessary, but it's not integrated into a large national database.
I wonder, too, about, and I'm thinking about the videos that we watched yesterday, just about someone's gait and how they walk. I mean, is that something that is significant when it comes to identification and security cameras?
It can be. So gait has been used in the UK in a couple of court cases to help identify a suspect. It is difficult because you have to figure out, where did you collect the information about that person? Gait has been studied by various federal agencies for accuracy. And, again, it's an identifier that will help rule out people, will help whittle down your suspects, but there's only a certain amount of information you can get. And if a person hasn't been enrolled, where did you get the information from? But it's a great way of helping to track. Mm-hmm. It's the same person across cameras, so that when you have a low-resolution camera far away, you see this person walking across the street from two blocks away. You have no idea who they are, but you can see their gait. If you can then measure that same gait from a much closer camera, you can say, this is probably the same person. And, you know, because of timing and other incidents, there's not that many other people you have to differentiate from, and therefore help use that as a way of tracking your information over time.
You mentioned the UK, and I think anyone that's been to London knows that there are a lot of surveillance cameras. There's some here in Philadelphia. I was reading that Chicago has a lot of surveillance cameras. I don't know about Boston, but one would assume, Terry Bolt, that that they are probably in places that we don't expect, and probably more and more of them either used through law enforcement or government or private businesses as well.
Yeah, I would say that, in fact, in Philadelphia, Boston, the dominant place for there to be cameras is actually private businesses that want to protect themselves, so they'll have an internal video surveillance system. Lots of companies have that internally, and then they can share that information with law enforcement when it's necessary. In cities, there's lots of public infrastructure. For example, Philadelphia actually has cameras on street corners that are used for things not necessarily for this. They're used for monitoring traffic and stoplight cameras to check people running red lights, but those same cameras might be used for other things. Then there's other outward-facing cameras on things like ATMs and whatever that may or may not be useful for such information. The infrastructure for the city rarely has a lot of dedicated cameras. New York City has some. I don't know if Boston has many.
And is there an alert system? I mean, if a camera sees something that seems unusual, or perhaps even a camera that's in either a high-traffic area or a secure area sees something, is there an alert system that might go off?
So there are systems that are commercially available and have been deployed in various cities that include things like left baggage detection. But it's a very difficult scenario to deal with, because if you imagine that someone puts a bag down next to the trash can, if you set off an alert every time somebody does that, somebody has to go respond to that. So then you have to think about what the response model, how it's doing it. In very high concern areas like airports, these systems have much more potential to be used because they have a large number of staff and there's great concern about this. In an area like a city street, it would be impractical to send a police officer every time somebody left a piece of trash or, a box or whatever on the ground. There's just too much of that. That is an innocent thing going on. Of course, if you give a big enough fine for littering, I guess maybe you could make up the difference.
Indeed. That's Terry Bolt, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, and we're talking about security cameras, surveillance, and certainly the role that it appears that they have played in the bombing investigation in Boston. And again, if you have any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Terry Bolt, would it be fair to say that, looking through all these images, that it makes more sense to have a computer do that than to have actual human beings looking through all these databases?
Actually, at this time, I would say it's the investigators of the FBI have done a great job, and there's no recognition system anywhere close to what humans can do. And so in that sense, the law enforcement people are trained to do this. They're looking for connections and possible information, having computers help them to make their job easier. So if they get to the point where they say, is this person in any other images, find them for me, and then they can start making inferences from it. That kind of stuff, computers can help them, but computers shouldn't be left alone to try and find people, because there's just too much ambiguity into what's going on, and there's too much difficulty across many views, many cameras. It's a very, very hard problem. Even for a trained expert, it's hard to always make these associations. So the role of computers is to help the investigators become more efficient, not to in any way try and replace them. The number of people in Boston that are on a camera, I don't know what it is in Boston, but in London, where there's millions of inhabitants, everyone is on a camera like 20 times a day. Right? So you'll always find somebody's in this camera and this camera and that camera. Being on the camera doesn't make them suspicious when the cameras are ubiquitous. Everybody's on them all the time. The question is, who's acting suspicious or who has other reasons? So they knew something about the backpack, so then starting to look for, okay, which of the images had black backpacks? Okay, now you start whittling down the crowd. Tools to help officers do that are things that don't really exist in the level they should. The ability to ask questions instead of saying, for facial recognition, who is this person? The ability to say, well, here are some general characteristics. Search through my list of images and find me all the people that have mild skin, a big nose, black hair, and a black shirt on today. Find me all those images. those kinds of technologies are places where there's continuing research going on to advance the state-of-the-art to provide those kinds of tools to law enforcement.
What appears to be a breakthrough in this particular case is that the suspects went to a 7-Eleven after they had been identified by the FBI and apparently caught on that 7-Eleven surveillance camera.
Well, yeah, in our integrated world, once they've decided that this person of interest, there's a lot of cameras out there, so they can begin to try and track this person's location. They also had cell phone information, you know, trying to utilize where were they. They knew when they were on a cell phone. What can they do to reduce the population? So finding that down and then, you know, getting lucky that they went into a place where there was a camera with a better view of them than any of the street cameras provides the FBI then a better image of the person to start trying to find out who they are, and where might they be.
Of course, there are limitations to this as well. Can you talk about that?
So facial recognition has lots of limitations. The worse the image, so many of these images are blurry. I'm sure we've all watched TV when there's a Crime Stoppers thing or whatever, and you look at these photos like, even if I knew this person, I wouldn't know who they are because the images are so bad. Both suspects had caps on for many of the images, sunglasses. There's lots of things we can do to make it much harder, or people do to make it much harder for humans to recognize them. And as soon as humans can't recognize them, the machines are farther down the chain. So the limitations are, as I said, they're not going to go through the list of everyone in the city and say, this is the person, but they can say it's not lots of people, whittle down the pool, and whoever's left is where they can then focus their attentions.
And is this, are these images, are they admissible in court?
Well, they're images. They're, so you can talk about the history of where they came from. These images are, humans in the jury can look at this image, look at the suspect, and decide, are they related? That's one of the powerful advantages you get for images. It's, in some sense, much better than an eyewitness that says, yes, I saw them, because now the jury can't make their own decision. They have to look and say, this person is saying they saw them. How well did they recognize them? How good was the, you know, their view of them is harder to assess. So providing the information, because it's captured and usable directly in court, provides both sides a fair balance. It is an image. It's up to everyone else to assess, is it the same person or not, which is different than having had a computer say, this is the match. They don't get a choice of that. The computer said they match or not. What probability? So entering it in admissible evidence in court also depends on the Daubert process and how scientifically backed it is. So showing the images doesn't require that. You just have to talk about the history of them. To have a computer say this is the same person's walk, which has been used in court cases in London, you have to go a little bit farther to show, well, how many other people would have been confused with that, and that makes it a lot more difficult. So images in court are great because it's real evidence. It was collected. You know what it's up to the jury to then interpret.
I thought it was interesting that the lead FBI investigator criticized the tabloid in New York City that had posted the wrong pictures. I mean, had put up on their front page the wrong pictures. And I guess it underscores the importance of the media behaving themselves, of course. But the FBI lead investigator underscoring, saying, these are the pictures that we are looking at. Do not be distracted by false images out there. How important is that?
It's important at two different levels. The photos that the FBI are putting forward, these are the persons of interest. You know, somebody showing a different photo just confuses both the people who are out there as to who might be subjects. It's also particularly unfortunate for whoever was in those other photos, right? If they weren't a person of interest, people think they might be the bombers in Boston, you know, their lives could literally be in danger because of misinformation. Mm-hmm. It's always a tricky thing, right? We have this presumption of innocence, even for the suspects the FBI are putting out. Putting those photos out could put, if they're not the right suspects. So the investigation spends a lot of time trying to make sure they have a credible suspect before they would release those photos. They don't just say, well, here's photos of people that were in Boston, because that would be dangerous.
Indeed. How important are security cameras, surveillance, as just a form of deterrence?
So deterrence is actually one of the better values for video surveillance. There have been multiple formal studies where groups have looked at what the cameras do. People are less likely to commit premeditated crimes in the area where they know there's a surveillance camera. But crimes of passion, so where people aren't thinking, aren't going to be really deterred. But people, if they know they're being watched, are less likely to do certain kinds of things. It becomes difficult, as the previous speaker on the call talked about, the if you have a suicide bomber, they're clearly not worried. They're not going to be deterred because the camera's going to watch them. In fact, right. We can flip some of this around and turn it to the other side. If they're looking to get media attention for their cause, being caught on camera or being on camera is part of what they want. So there's a balance. It's both a deterrent, but at the same time helps them gain media attention and get to the infamy that they're looking for and what they're doing. So it's a double-edged sword. I don't know that it would deter most terrorists. It would stop somebody trying to plan a robbery because they don't want to be caught. These probably people didn't seem to want to be caught, but there's a balance on that line and how far they would go. I don't think the 9/11 bombers would have been deterred if they knew they were going to be caught in video surveillance. They were. That wasn't going to stop them.
And Terry Bolt, just final question. We have to say goodbye in about 30 seconds, and I asked this of our previous guests as well. What will you be then looking for as this story unfolds as someone with an expertise in security and cameras?
Well, I'll have my natural interest in if the FBI releases the story. There's lots of stuff that goes on behind the scenes we will never know. They haven't yet released the photo of the person leaving the backpack. Some of that needs to be saved for prosecution so that we haven't completely tainted the entire pool of jurors and whatever. But I'll be interested to see if they actually do describe any other technological uses. How many other suspects they have and how they whittle the pool down to this is always the kind of stuff that'll be interesting. And I have the privacy side of me that worries about this kind of instance being used for a push for greater amounts of automated video surveillance without actually showing that automated video surveillance would solve those problems. The FBI did a great job of using the assets they have, but we have to worry also about balancing how effective it would be if we tried to automate all of this.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Terry Bolt, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. He's at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Emily Bryant helping us out today. Kevin Griffin, our engineer, and working very hard behind the scenes today to put this hour together. Susan Greenbaum and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.